probably what we need. Unfortunately, I don't think that's going to happen.
Thank you so much. Have a very good afternoon.
Though President Macron said Johnson apologised privately for blaming France publicly about the Channel crossings and the food-related so-called sausage war, he also said of the UK, "It is sad to see a major country with which we could do huge numbers of things being led by a clown." Former French ambassador to the UK, Sylvie Berman, has also stated that relations between France and the UK were the worst they had been since the Battle of Waterloo hundreds of years ago.
Anglo-French relations are at a modern-day low, and no one appears able to de-escalate this ongoing exchange of insults. With America also unable to mediate, France and Britain are left to battle it out in a very public dispute where two premiers treat each other as a scapegoat and a clown. No shots will be fired, but it appears both sides are rerunning their own version of the Battle of Waterloo. Though, in public relations terms, at this stage, the outcome, namely who will win, is very much in doubt.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio programme. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com macron.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
Dear listeners, today we're going to continue our discussion about Imam Khomeini's views on the armed forces. Please stay with us. The late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, writes in his testament, "In Iran, where this miracle of the age, the Islamic Revolution, was worked by the people, the committed armed forces and the pure and patriotic commanders had a significant share. And today, as Saddam's war that has been imposed by the order and support of America and other superpowers has faced a political and military defeat by the invading Ba'athist army and its powerful supporters and their lackeys, it is again the armed forces and the new law enforcement forces, the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps and popular forces, who created this great honour in the fronts with the unsparing support of the nation. They made Iran proud, and the internal mischief and plots that had been mobilised by the puppets affiliated to the East and the West to overthrow the Islamic Republic were thwarted by the able hands of the younger generation of the Islamic Revolutionary Committees, the Basij Volunteer Forces, the police, with the help of the brave people. It is the same dear selfness, younger generation, who stay awake at night so that the families rest calmly. May God bless them." The founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, the late Imam Khomeini, continues, "I recommend kindly to all armed forces, in the end of the life of this world, just as they have been loyal, to be firmly loyal to Islam, which is the only religion of independence and freedom, and Almighty God has invited all to the lofty human status, with its light of guidance. It is Islam that rescues you, your country and your nation from the strain of dependence and affiliation to the powers who do not want you, except for their slavery, and keep your dear country and nation backward and the consumption market and under the shameful oppression. Prefer noble human life, even with problems, to the shameful life of slavery of foreigners, even if it is with animal welfare." The late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, writes further in his testament, "My brotherly recommendation in the final steps of my life to the armed forces generally is that, O dear ones, who love Islam and continue self-sacrifice in the fronts and all over the country with the love of meeting God, be vigilant and alert as the political players and the West-toxicated and East-toxicated professional politicians and stealthy, mysterious hands have focused the sharp weapon of treachery and crime from every side towards you, dear ones, more than any other group, and they want to exploit your dear ones, who have made the revolution victorious and revived Islam with your sacrifices, to topple the Islamic Republic. And they want to separate you from Islam, and they want you to separate from the nation, and they don't want you to serve the country, and they want to throw you in the lap of one of the two world-devouring powers, and they want to nullify your efforts and sacrifices by political deception, tricks in the Islamic and national form. Imam Khomeini then refers to the backwardness of Iran, saying, "After this, much of artificial backwardness to the great industries of the foreign countries, our need is an undeniable reality. This does not mean that we should be dependent on one of the superpowers in the advanced sciences. The government and the army should make effort to send committed students to the countries which have great advanced industries while they're not colonialists and exploiters, and they should refrain from sending the students to America and the Soviet Union and other countries which are in the direction of these two poles. Perhaps, God willing, one day will come that these two powers will come to their senses and march in the path of humanity and humanitarianism and respect other people's rights. Or, God willing, the downtrodden of the world and the vigilant nations and committed Muslims will put them in their places." The founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, the late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, writes further in his testament, "Know that as long as you extend your hand to others in advanced industries and spend your life in begging, the power of innovation and advancement in inventions would not flourish within you. And you saw clearly that in this short period after the economic sanctions, those who considered themselves unable to make anything and were disappointed of driving factories, put their thoughts into action and met many needs of the army and factories themselves. And this war, the economic sanction and expulsion of the foreign experts, were a divine gift, which we were negligent of. Now, if the government and the army sanction the goods of the world devourers and increase their effort in the way of innovation, it is hoped that the country will be self-sufficient and will be saved from begging the enemy." The late Imam Khomeini continued by saying, "We saw that many factories and advanced tools like aircrafts and other industrialized goods, which were not thought to be started by Iranian specialists, and all hands were extended towards the West and the East so that their specialists would start them. As a result of the economic sanction and the imposed war, our dear young people have made the needed parts and supplied them in lower prices, and have proved that we can if we want to."
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The UN Security Council meeting turned into a heated argument between Moscow and Washington. The US and Russian delegates exchanged accusations over alleged biological weapons in Ukraine. The Russian envoy warned the European countries of the danger posed by Ukraine's research into biological weapons. Russia says the US-funded biolabs have researched spreading the highly infectious bird flu virus through migratory birds and pathogens such as bacteria and viruses that can be transmitted from bats to humans. The US, however, rejected Russia's allegation of biological activities, claiming that biological laboratories in Ukraine have nothing to do with chemical arms. It also interpreted the accusation as a sign that Moscow plans to use chemical or biological weapons in Ukraine. Washington initially condemned Russia for spreading disinformation. Nevertheless, after Russia published documents showing that Kyiv was ordered to urgently eliminate traces of what was deemed as a biological weapons program financed by the Pentagon, U.S. Undersecretary of State Victoria Nuland admitted the existence of U.S.-funded biological research facilities in the country, saying Washington is working with Kyiv to prevent Russia from getting the research materials. The contradictory remarks further deepen the world's doubts about the US. Why is the US hastily attempting to destroy the materials? Is it trying to hide something?
Well, first of all, the United States specializes in moving its chemical and biological weapons activities away from its own territory to allow itself a degree of deniability. In other words, we didn't do that. It was a private venture of an academic institute or of a government department not related to the militaries.
The United States has spent more than $200 million on the work of biological laboratories in Ukraine. It has 30 biological laboratories and other related facilities in the country which are possibly involved in the production of bioweapons. And these are less than 10% of the 336 biological laboratories the U.S. reportedly controls in 30 countries around the world. Deputy Chairman of the Council of Ministers of Crimea, Georgi Muradov, says the United States had plans to open a biolab on the peninsula before its annexation to Russia. He also accused the Pentagon of developing biological weapons in its secret laboratories under Ukrainian territory. Also, China has called on the United States to release all-around details of its biological laboratories in Ukraine and urged relevant parties to ensure their safety. The U.S. has blocked the building of the Biological Weapons Convention Verification Protocol for 2 decades and refused to accept inspections of biological facilities within and outside its borders, despite having over 300 biological laboratories all over the world. It seems that by doing so, the U.S. wants to protect the secrets of its biological labs worldwide. It's reasonable and legitimate for the international community to question the U.S. for that, especially since it has a history of using chemical weapons. The U.S. dropped massive quantities of white phosphorus on the Iraqi city of Fallujah during an attack on the city in November 2004, killing insurgents and civilians with the appalling burns that are the signature of this weapon. Also, 5 decades after the Vietnam War ended, Agent Orange continues to impact communities in Vietnam and Laos today. It contained dioxin, one of the most toxic chemicals known to humans. It is linked to increased rates of cancers and birth defects. Vietnam says several million people have been affected by Agent Orange, including 150,000 children born with severe birth defects.
Well, the United States has always managed to present two faces to the world. One is the face of the American democracy attempting to achieve peace, according to their propaganda, and the other is the military-industrial complex that runs the American economy by making wars. So the political element of the U.S. system denies involvement in such activities, while behind the back of the public, even the American public, is deceived in order to keep the regime popular at home. But behind the back of the American public, the United States is more involved than any other country in the world in these areas.
Biological weapons are seen as weapons of mass destruction together with nuclear and chemical weapons. Any suspicion of biological weapons must be promptly investigated. Therefore, the U.S. owes the world an answer on what it has been up to in its so-called biological research facilities in Ukraine.
September 11, 2001. The United States is hit by 4 coordinated terrorist attacks, the first major assault on the U.S. soil since World War II. Nearly 3,000 people are killed and some 20,000 others injured. The U.S. responds with an all-out war on Afghanistan, where the terror group Al-Qaeda that planned and carried out the attack was said to be based. Fast forward 20 years. U.S. President Joe Biden signed an executive order in September giving the Justice Department a 6-month notice to release the documents on the FBI's investigations into the incident. Yet on Thursday, the department acknowledged that it would miss the deadline, suggesting that they would be released by mid-April. It says the delay is due to continuing coordination with a number of foreign governments and ongoing interagency review. One of the governments in question is likely to be Saudi Arabia. Out of 19 terrorists involved in the attacks, 15 were Saudi nationals. The close ties between Al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden and the Saudi royal family also raised questions that Saudi Arabian authorities supported the operation. Some observers believe the conflict in Ukraine and the West's sweeping sanctions on Russia, especially its energy sector, which has sent fuel prices skyrocketing around the world, could explain the delay in the release of the documents, as the United States needs Saudi Arabia, with the world's second largest oil reserves, to fill in the gap.
And obviously there's a quid pro quo going on here. How serious it's going to be is another question. You still got, hanging over all of this, the fact that Vice President Cheney at the time, in 9/11, arranged for all these Saudis to leave the country, leave the United States and go back to Saudi Arabia. So there was no follow-up at the time, contemporaneously, with the Saudi presence in the United States, or the fact that most of the people who were involved in the actual hijackings of these planes were Saudis. So clearly there is something here that is extremely troubling. And clearly the Saudis do not want this out. And I suspect there are large sections of the United States government who are not interested in having a serious discussion about this.
But the delay isn't good news to thousands of families who are seeking justice for the loved ones they lost on 9/11. Soon after taking office, Joe Biden said the U.S. was ending all its support for Saudi Arabia's war on Yemen, proclaiming that the war has to end. But, back in September, the U.S. State Department approved its first major arms sale to the kingdom under President Biden, with the sale of 280 air-to-air missiles valued at up to $650 million. President Biden has broken another promise about defending humanitarian rights, an issue he staked much of his presidency on. Back in February, a declassified U.S. intelligence report concluded that Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman authorized a team of Saudi security and intelligence officials to kill dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi in 2018. But Biden later decided not to punish bin Salman, saying it would be diplomatically unprecedented for the United States.
It's unlikely that people are going to support the United States in the hour of need without some concessions. I mean, I just don't see it. It's possible, I suppose. Maybe there's some threats or whatever, but it's unlikely. And the Saudis have been very clear in the paper today. They said they want more support by the United States for their adventure in Yemen, among other things. There was a list.
The U.S. takes in stride the violations perpetrated by its allies while accusing countries it deems its adversaries of the same charges. But will it forgive possible perpetrators of attacks on its own citizens too? What message would that have for the attackers? Wouldn't that embolden them to commit even worse crimes, knowing that they can get away with murder in its most literal sense?
As the war between Russia and Ukraine drags on, there are indications that Ukraine has hosted U.S.-funded labs to develop biological weapons. U.S. Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs Victoria Nuland has admitted that Ukraine hosts biological research facilities.
Ukraine has biological research facilities, which, in fact, we are now quite concerned Russian troops, Russian forces may be seeking to gain control of. So we are working with the Ukrainians on how they can prevent any of those research materials from falling into the hands of Russian forces.
So that Victoria Nuland, the guru of the Maidan, who was passing out cookies to the fascist Azov battalion in 2014 during the coup against the legitimate government, was forced to admit that these facilities were there. She didn't clarify what they were exactly, but she indicated that that they were dismantled quickly in order to prevent them from falling into the hands of the Russians.
The admission came after Russia published documents showing that Kiev was ordered to urgently eliminate traces of what was deemed as a biological weapons program financed by the Pentagon. The dangerous pathogens across Ukrainian biolab facilities included anthrax, the plague, tularemia, cholera, and other deadly diseases. In the past several days, long-standing fears, which we have expressed repeatedly for years, regarding the development of military biological materials by the United States on the territory of Ukraine under the auspices of the relevant U.S. Special Services, have been confirmed. Earlier, the Russian Defense Ministry said it had found evidence of U.S.-funded biolabs in Ukraine, which had urgently destroyed samples of deadly pathogens when the military offensive started.
I think the United States was caught by surprise now. At first, they've been denying all the accusations that are being made, you know, over the past few months that they're conducting biological warfare research. You had this incident here, which initially they really couldn't deny.
Russia says U.S. statements about Ukraine's biolabs indicate fears by Washington that the pathogens stored there may fall into the hands of Russian experts. Moscow says they confirmed the U.S.'s violation of the Biological and Toxin Weapons Convention.
So either through surrogate or directly, the United States seems to have been involved in creating a capability would give a country, an allied country, or the United States a possibility to conduct biological warfare. And that, of course, is forbidden by a variety of U.N. conventions.
Russia says it had been closely monitoring the bioweapons programs that were developed by the Pentagon in post-Soviet countries. Russia has accused the U.S. of working in Ukraine since 2005 and being involved in the construction, modernization, and operation of over a dozen biolabs suitable for storing or working with pathogens, including those used in bioweapons.
The fact that they existed in Ukraine, where there was a almost obsessive concern and hatred, I must say, among some of the leading factions, right-wing factions in the Ukrainian government against Russia, that they, I think, would be quite prepared to use them in a war with someone they considered their deadly foe. And if they did so, it was with the whole backing of the United States, who set up these facilities in the first place.
Moscow has expressed deep concerns about these facilities in recent years. Moscow says facilities in Ukraine were developing components for biological weapons, noting that in the near future, the ministry would release its analysis of the received documents. Russia also accuses the U.S. of sponsoring biological labs across a number of former Soviet republics, including Kazakhstan, Armenia, Tajikistan, and Georgia.
The aerospace force of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps successfully put a reconnaissance satellite into orbit. The Noor-2 was launched from Imam Khomeini's spaceport in Semnan province. The satellite reached a low orbit of 500 kilometers above the Earth on an Iranian three-stage Qassid carrier, which used a combination of liquid and solid fuels. The Noor-2 became Iran's second military satellite successfully placed in low Earth orbit. Commander of the Space Command of the IRGC's Aerospace Force said Iran's national space and defense organizations, knowledge-based companies, and universities cooperated in the Noor-2 project. Brigadier General Ali Jafarabadi explained that the domestically manufactured satellite incorporates the newest technology. It is the upgraded version of Noor-1, which was launched into orbit 21 months ago. Data obtained by Iran's second military satellite can have multiple general and defensive uses. The Noor-2 will orbit the Earth every 90 minutes and will pass over the Iranian sky 16 times every day. Its mission will last at least 3 years. The commander explained that the IRGC will launch a series of Noor satellites in the coming years to consolidate its position in low Earth orbit before aiming for the orbit 36,000 kilometers above land. The latest achievements of Iran's space program came a few days after the IRGC unveiled two underground bases housing state-of-the-art missiles and attack drones. Iran has been relentlessly developing new weapons and military equipment, arguing that it needs the means to defend itself in the world's most volatile region. Just weeks ago, the country unveiled a state-of-the-art ballistic missile with pinpoint precision. Khaybar Shekan boasts high maneuverability when it dives down, making it a nightmare for the world's most advanced missile shields. Iranians have stressed that their defense program grew out of the war initiated by Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein in the 1980s. Saddam's forces showered Iranian cities with missiles and bombs provided by the East and the West, while Iranians say no one sold them any proper means of defense. Iranians argue that they have no choice but to build their own defense industry. The latest achievements strongly suggest that Iran's pursuit of robust defense capabilities is in full swing despite stringent American sanctions.
I think that these developments send several interrelated messages, the first and foremost being that Iran's technological development will not be held back by the obviously failed efforts of the United States and its allies to curtail Iranian technological development. It sends another similar message regarding sanctions, that sanctions are going to be completely ineffectual in terms of holding back Iran's scientific as well as industrial development.
Iran is still engaged in the negotiations in the Austrian capital aimed at removing the sanctions, but its defense industries are not waiting for the talks to end in an agreement. Observers believe Iran's launch of a military satellite into orbit as talks in Vienna are still underway is sending a clear message that it will never negotiate over its defense capabilities and that no agreement can ever restrict its defense, missile, and space programs. The Islamic Republic has made it clear that it will never ask for permission from anyone to manufacture its own means of defense.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Nearly 2 years into the pandemic, it is clear that the coronavirus is not going to disappear anytime soon. Surges will happen, variants of concern will pop up, and mitigation strategies will need to evolve. Yet too many Americans are still paralyzed with doubt and fear over each new uncertainty, as trust in U.S. government and other institutions to manage the virus ranges from shaky to non-existent. This opinion article has been written by the editorial board of the New York Times. The piece is titled, "We Can Live Better Lives While Being Smart About COVID." Nearly 2 years into the pandemic, it is clear that the coronavirus is not going to disappear anytime soon. Surges will happen, variants of concern will pop up, and mitigation strategies will need to evolve. Yet too many Americans are still paralyzed with doubt and fear over each new uncertainty, as trust in the U.S. government and other institutions to manage the virus ranges from shaky to non-existent. It is past time to ask ourselves, as another COVID winter begins, if we have to keep living like this, anxious over the unknown, worried about large indoor gatherings, tense at every bit of virus news, and frustrated and at times contemptuous of fellow Americans who have a dramatically different sense of acceptable risk. Because progress has been made this year, vaccines that protect against serious illness and death are taking ever greater hold in the United States and are beginning to make their way into the world's most vulnerable regions. Drugs that work against the virus are coming through the pipeline, and despite a recent uptick in cases, schools and businesses remain open. Americans should pause a moment and let this progress sink in. The virus will continue to surprise us, and even when scientists manage to predict its worst turns, officials will not necessarily be able to prevent those turns from coming. But what if leaders at all levels made choices so that we don't have to exhaust ourselves with stress over every curveball? To help us all live more normally with this virus rather than let it control us. That exhaustion has characterized so much of the past 2 years, as parents, teachers, frontline healthcare workers, and small business owners wade through what can feel like an unending morass. Is it safe to celebrate the holidays? Will schools shut down again? When will young children finally be eligible for vaccines? And why are we still having to ask ourselves these questions? It is too soon to say how long the current surge will last or how it might be shaped by the Omicron variant. But even amid that uncertainty, we should push for a more pragmatic path from our decision makers that will help us protect ourselves and live more normal lives, even as the virus continues to evolve. Make coronavirus testing as fast, easy, and inexpensive as possible. Ubiquitous testing could help schools stay open and make gatherings of every kind safer. With more than 1,000 people still dying of COVID-19 every day in the United States, it's past time to make this basic tool as readily available as it is in other countries like in South Korea or Britain. President Biden's latest plan, which would require people with private health insurance to submit a claim for reimbursement and people without health insurance or private coverage to hunt down free tests at community health centers, does not do nearly enough to achieve that goal. Instead, the Biden administration should do what other countries have done and what the United States did so successfully with vaccines. Work directly with companies to get more tests approved and undermarket quickly, use advance purchasing agreements to ensure a steady supply of those tests, and create federal subsidies for clinics and pharmacies to provide them free or very cheap to consumers who want them. Aim to make the 2021-2022 school year the last dominated by COVID. The Biden administration should have enough testing free and available and push to have a critical mass of students vaccinated by September. Quarantine and isolation policies will also need an upgrade. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, still advises people to isolate for 10 days after experiencing symptoms or testing positive, regardless of their vaccination status. Many schools still require anyone who's been in contact with an infected person to quarantine for several days, at least. As breakthrough infections become more common, even among those who have received their booster shots, it makes sense to allow workers and students to avoid confinement or test their way out of it much more quickly. Wearing face masks in schools is uniquely challenging. No one wants to force young children to wear face masks for several hours a day indefinitely, but it would also be foolish to abandon the practice completely. A happy medium may be to require face masks for students during surges or when new variants of concern are detected and vaccine escape is still being measured. The rest of the time, evidence so far suggests the requirement could be lifted. Nevada has successfully tied its school masking mandates to community transmission rates, and experts say it is worth trying the same in other states as well. We must all prepare for surges. No scientist or health official has managed to predict or even explain after the fact what constellation of forces causes the pandemic to ebb and flow around the globe the way it has. But it's clear that there will continue to be periods of substantial uptick in coronavirus cases, and there should be sensible, significantly better policies in place for dealing with them. Country-specific travel bans are futile. By the time a variant like Omicron is detected in one country, it's already spread halfway around the globe. Penalizing countries that report new variants, as South Africa did with Omicron variant, will only discourage them from sharing that kind of information in the future. Blanket policies, like requiring everyone entering the United States to test negative or possibly quarantine, would be tougher and more expensive to carry out. It would also have a better chance of actually working. If federal officials are serious about using border control to slow the spread of dangerous pathogens, they will need to establish clear, enforceable test and quarantine protocols, not to mention adequate quarantine facilities at ports of entry. Do away with COVID theatre. The coronavirus is airborne, and any money spent on deep cleaning would be better put towards improved building ventilation. But instead of upgrading their HVAC systems, too many schools and businesses are still relying on things that won't work nearly as well. The plastic barriers that have become common in restaurants, nail salons and offices, for example, can actually impede airflow and exacerbate viral spread. Lawmakers and local officials should make a concerted effort to change that. Not only would improved ventilation help thwart coronavirus, it would also curb the spread of other airborne pathogens, including the flu and those that cause the common cold. Keep going on vaccines. Public health powers were once a common feature of American life, when cholera and yellow fever routinely stalked the nation's major cities, citizens accepted and expected their health departments to issue mandates, quarantine orders, and travel restrictions. It's crucial for officials to shore up those powers now, because scientists say the epidemics and pandemics will only become more common in the years ahead. President Biden's vaccine mandates have been bold and effective, and administration officials should stay the course no matter how many legal battles they encounter. In the meantime, government officials and private businesses would do well to stand firm on some basics. COVID vaccines should be required for public employees and in large companies, for healthcare workers, in schools, for staff, as well as for students for whom the vaccine shots are authorized, and for a range of indoor activities, including dining in restaurants and attending concerts. Face masks should be worn again in indoor public settings anytime transmission rates are high, vaccination rates are low, or new variants of concern are circulating. Even as we remain vigilant against the coronavirus, we need not remain in a state of paralyzing hypervigilance. Returning to the sound basics of public health, continuing the progress of medical innovation and ratcheting back the societal anxiety around the pandemic could make us all a lot healthier.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
People in the blockaded Gaza Strip attended a big ceremony to mark the 54th anniversary of the Palestinian Wounded Persons Day. The annual event pays tribute to the tens of thousands of Palestinians who got injured during Israeli wars and aggressions. Thousands of injured Palestinians suffered from permanent disabilities during Israeli wars. Israeli forces have also injured some 30,000 peaceful Palestinian protesters who were taking part in the Great March of Return rallies. Hamas movement, which organized the event, accused the Israeli regime of committing crimes against the Palestinian people.
The amount, the volume, the size of the injury indicated that we are facing a criminal side, which is occupation. I think it is very important indication about the type and the impact of the Israeli actions, Israeli crimes against the Palestinian.
During the Israeli war in May of 2021, over 2,200 Palestinians were injured, including 685 children and 480 women, some of whom may suffer a long-term disability requiring rehabilitation.
We have to stress the role of the wounded in Palestine and their great role. They are Palestinian, you know, wounded are in the first line with the occupation. So they sacrifice with their bodies in order to, free Palestine.
Palestinians say that Tel Aviv's crimes will continue to go unpunished as long as it enjoys protection from Western countries. The Islamic Jihad movement accused the United States of encouraging Israeli crimes against the Palestinian people.
I think that who give the Israeli the green lights, Americans, the United States of America, and the silence of people, which silenced all over the massacre which carried by the Israelis against our people, and also maybe the Arab position, so that the Israelis go on to hit, to destroy, to kill, to injure everything against our people.
The Israeli blockade in place since 2007 has made it even worse for wounded Gazans who require rehabilitation and artificial limbs.
Israeli forces have killed and injured thousands of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip since 2008, amid what observers describe as an international conspiracy of silence. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
C'est
South Korea elected a new president Wednesday as conservative People Power Party candidate Yoon Suk-yeol defeated progressive Lee Jae-myung by less than 1% after all the votes were tallied. Yoon was quick to outline the hard line he will take with North Korea.
In order to protect the safety of our people, property, territory, and sovereignty, we will build a strong military capacity that can reliably suppress any provocation. I'll firmly deal with illicit, unreasonable behavior by North Korea in a principled manner, though I'll always leave the door for South-North talks open.
North Korea conducted several missile tests in the weeks leading up to the election. Some analysts believe President-elect Yoon, a former prosecutor entering politics for the first time, will face some early challenges from Pyongyang.
The Conservative Party has been very critical of the government's position on military exercises. Of course, South Korea will come out with a new North Korea policy, but North Korea will also conduct a couple of activities to test the Yoon administration. I'm not sure whether this will lead to conflict or dialogue.
The Moon Jae-in administration had sought engagement with North Korea, but its policies were often stymied by a hardline U.S. approach. Yoon Suk-yeol's foreign policy marks a stark turnaround from outgoing President Moon Jae-in, particularly concerning North Korea. Yoon advocates the deployment of a second U.S. anti-ballistic missile battery to protect the capital, Seoul, the resumption of joint U.S.-South Korean military exercises, and the preparation for South Korea's military to execute a preemptive strike on North Korea should Pyongyang pose an imminent threat. In addition to the difficult North Korea issue, President-elect Yoon will have to deal with a raft of domestic problems, including a housing price bubble and income gap, a surge in COVID-19, as well as rising inflation. Frank Smith, Seoul.
A Cult in Heart of the Republic is the title of a book written by a member of the French Senate, Nathalie Goulet. In her book, she shines a light into the formidable anti-Iran terror group known as Mojahedin-e-Khalq Organization, or simply the MKO. The author tries to warn her fellow Senate members that a full-scale terror group exists in the heart of the French Republic. Here, in Iran's city of Qom, political thinkers and activists have gathered to unveil the first Persian translation of the French book.
In the book, A Cult in Heart of the Republic, Mrs. Goulet writes about the grisly crimes against humanity perpetrated by the MKO and how they crushed all humanitarian principles to ascend to power in Iran. The author warns the French parliament that the formidable group now enjoys full financial support from Paris and is infiltrating into the French government.
The group also fought alongside Iraqi forces against Iran during the eight-year Iran-Iraq War in the 1980s.
During the early days of the victory of the Islamic Revolution, the group tried to take power in Iran. But when they failed because of lack of popularity, they tried to deal a blow to the Islamic Republic. The MKO brainwashes its members and does not allow them to get married and form a family. They are like a war machine, which are designed to kill.
In 2012, the U.S. and Europe delisted the MKO as a terrorist organization. The terror group was then relocated from an American military base in Iraq to Albania and France. Since then, the U.S. and Europe have been taking part in the MKO's annual summits in Paris. Nathalie Goulet's book tries to highlight the criminal track record of the MKO, while warning France that it's making a big mistake by supporting the terror group.
France is a country that claims to care about money laundering on the global stage. But based on Nathalie Goulet's book, the French government is conducting large-scale money laundering to fund the MKO terrorists. The U.S. also lends its political support to the terror group. This is both double standards and folly, because the MKO's functionality has long expired.
The MKO is currently led by 68-year-old Maryam Rajavi, who is facing pressure from French human rights entities as, quote, a smear on France's record of human rights advocacy.
Aside from warning France of the security threats posed to her country by the MKO, the French author says capitalizing on the terror group is nothing but a waste of time and money. She argues that the MKO is viewed as an obsolete killing machine in the minds of Iranians and has no place in Iran's sociopolitical structure. Yusuf Jalali from the city of Qom.
Thank you.
Massive explosions lit up the night sky over Erbil, the capital of Iraq's northern Kurdistan region, in the early hours of Sunday. Initial reports pointed to the detonation of as many as 12 ballistic missiles. Then a statement came from Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, the IRGC. The force said it had fired powerful and precision strike missiles, targeting a strategic Israeli center for conspiracy and villainy. The IRGC said the attack follows Israel's recent crimes and promised that those atrocities would not go unanswered. The IRGC warned that further Israeli acts of aggression would receive a tough, decisive, and destructive response. Israel has long been blamed for a wide range of anti-Iran measures, including acts of sabotage against its nuclear facilities and the assassination of Iranian scientists. Former Israeli officials have also confirmed the regime's role in the U.S. assassination of top Iranian general Qasem Soleimani in Iraq in 2020. And just last week, two IRGC officers were killed in an Israeli airstrike on the Syrian capital, Damascus. At the time, the IRGC vowed that Israel would pay for the crime. In 2018, Israel killed a number of Iranians during an attack on an airbase near the city of Homs in western Syria. Iran later retaliated with a barrage of missiles targeting Israeli military positions in the occupied Golan Heights. The missile strike on Erbil could be seen in the same light. Iraq's Kurdistan regional government officials have denied the presence of Israeli bases in Erbil, but the two sides enjoy friendly ties. Back in 2014, Israel bought Kurdish oil despite opposition from the central Iraqi government and threats to take legal action. 3 years later, Israel endorsed an independence referendum carried out in the Kurdistan region. And last year, Erbil hosted a conference on normalization of ties between Iraq and Israel, prompting a furore. The Kurdish regional government said it was not aware of the conference being organized. Some analysts believe Israel is pursuing several objectives in the Iraqi region.
Of course, they can also foment sectarianism in places like Iraq, you know, picking on individual weaknesses of people with the finances of the Americans or others. They can create, all sorts of divisions and hatred to create problems within these nations. And their primary purpose is really to encircle the Islamic Republic of Iran, which is the only nation and the most powerful nation that stands up for the oppressed in that region. And the primary oppressor in that region, of course, is Israel.
The IRGC says Iran's peace and security is a red line for Iranian armed forces, and they will not allow any harm to come to the country. Words that will now sound even more reassuring to the nation and forbidding to its enemies.
In Paris, demonstrators gathered to warn that while the world is distracted by the conflict in Ukraine, pro-Zionists are stepping up their violence and oppression against Palestinians worldwide.
A steady trend of murders. I mean, 2-3 teenagers assassinated per week. Hundreds, if not thousands, of olive trees uprooted. Houses demolished, night arrests. It's going on continuously.
At the major pre-election dinner held by France's top Jewish lobby, known by the acronym CREEF, France's prime minister announced the banning of two pro-Palestinian groups. The administration of President Emmanuel Macron has falsely declared anti-Zionism to be the same as anti-Semitism, and has already closed many of the nation's top Muslim and anti-racist organizations. Many around the world have been shocked at the swiftness with which the West is sanctioning Russia for its military operation in Ukraine, noting that nothing similar was even remotely attempted to help Yemen, Palestine, and so many other non-white conflict areas. Unlike Ukrainian refugees to the European Union, Palestinian refugees aren't being awarded visa papers, the right to work, medical care, rights to housing, and other social services.
In France, the government, almost all the media, all the political parties immediately stand for Ukraine. In a way, they launch in a minute a practical BDS, boycott, divestment, sanctions against Russia.
Western mainstream media and social media are openly encouraging armed resistance by Ukrainians against Russia, and yet resistance fighters in Palestine and other Muslim countries are called terrorists and subject to intense propaganda and censorship.